You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Genevieve Kosky,
Tasha Robinson,
Scott Tobias.
On the first half of this episode, we discussed Robert Downey Sr.'s countercultural cult classic, Putney Swope, and its take on the advertising world. With this half, we'll take a look at another film happy to take swings at capitalism, Boots Riley's Sorry to Bother You. This is Riley's debut as a film director, but music fans know him as the frontman of The Coup, a long-lived Oakland-based hip-hop group that, from its inception, has attempted to merge dope beats with radical politics. In some ways, Sorry to Bother You plays like an extension of that mission. Lakeith Stanfield plays Cassius Green, a down-on-his-luck Oakland resident who takes a job at the bottom-feeding telemarketing firm of Regalview. But all is not as it seems at Regalview. When a senior employee played by Danny Glover informs him that success awaits him if he'll put on his white voice, confident, a little nasal, more than a little unconcerned, he'll find greater success. Soon he's promoted to the rank of power caller and allowed access to levels of the business he never imagined before. As in Putney Swope, there's a lot going on here, including a foray into the art world by Cassius' girlfriend Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson, the Worry-Free Corporation and its promise of lifelong employment, a strike, and animal-human hybrids created by supercapitalist Steve Lift, played by Armie Hammer. What is this movie trying to say, and does it say it successfully? We'll talk about it after the break.
I just really need a job.
40 on 2.
This is telemarketing.
Stick to the script.
Hey, hello. Mr. Davidson, Cassius Green here. Sorry to bother.
Let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice?
I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview.
As always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
You're doing so good with the voice thing.
Holla, 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 holla!
Oh, yeah! All right!
Hell yeah! You're going upstairs, Power Caller.
They even have their own elevator.
Welcome, Power Caller. I hope you did not masturbate today. We need you sharp and ready to go.
Hey, I'm Boots Riley, they murder, yeah. Gonna get you popping like Percocet. Got me the banger ain't surface, yeah. Two stepping like the ball, this person, yeah.
I got promoted.
I'm a Power Caller.
What did I sell?
They're not selling, yeah. But we selling.
No, well, there's no amount of money that'll make me do that.
Here's the starting salary. Well, man, I'm gonna have to get me some new suits.
Yeah, whatever I wear, no, I'm here to be clear.
It is morally emaciated.
I can't ride with you.
I'm doing something I'm really good at.
Cash, I'm gonna make you a proposal. I can see that you want to say no, but I wouldn't do that before you see what I'm offering you. Cash, you are awesome.
Oh, yeah! All right!
So, first of all, did this movie work for you?
Yes.
Yes. I'm going to say
sure.
Yes for me, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Definitely. Are we done? Is that the end of the
episode? We solved it, guys. We've solved cinema.
I felt it losing like a little bit of energy and focus toward the back half. But even there, I'm thinking about all the things I liked about this movie. It is such a, it's a strange, idea-packed movie that's really funny. And, you know, kind of like as I stressed above, it's on mission. It definitely has a point to get across, and it gets it across. It does so in very clever ways that don't feel like edutainment.
I was delighted watching this film throughout just because I never knew where it was going to go next. And that is despite the fact that I have been reading about and editing pieces on this film for several months now, mm-hmm. like our Alyssa, our film critic, reviewed it out of Sundance, and she interviewed Boots Riley, Lakeith Stanfield, and Terry Crews about it, and I edited all those, and like I've read a lot about this film going into it, and I still was like constantly surprised and like not knowing where it was going while I was watching it. And that's like I talked a little bit in the Putney Swope half of this conversation about feeling like disoriented and not in a good way at sometimes with that film. Like this film, I did feel disoriented, but I was like totally along for the ride the whole time.
Nothing will prepare you for the Equisapiens, I don't think.
Yeah. I knew there was a shock coming. Like, I knew that there was, like, sort of a little body horror moment coming, but I thought it was coming with his white voice, like him not being able to turn off his white voice, and it ended up being something completely different.
Yeah, the Equisapiens, like, I first saw this film with Sundance, and but I didn't see the first screening of it, and film Twitter started blowing up with all of these tweets about horse cock. And I was just, I was like, that's, from what I understand what the film is about, why is that the thing that literally everybody is focusing on? But it's still radical to show a naked penis in a film. And it's apparently even more radical to show like a knee-length naked penis on a...
Why are we so puritanical, guys?
A horrific horse monster. There are things, much like with Putney Swope, there are things that this movie does that feel like the director doesn't know the rules or doesn't care about the rules and is like fomenting revolution, cinematic revolution. And it just feels... Both of these films just feel really daring. To some degree, Sorry to Bother You feels daring because it feels like it's cramming in so many things. I'm reminded of interviews I've done with directors making their first films who were like, I didn't know if I was going to get to make a second film, so I had to cram in everything I wanted to say. This film feels like it is commenting on so many things, you know, ranging from capitalism and advertisement and the gig economy to viral fame to just the horrors of unchecked corporate malfeasance to how we're presented racially to each other and just on and on and on. A safe film that's polished and planned is less interesting to me than something like this that's all over the place in a crazy fun way.
I feel like retweeting everything Tasha just said because all of us really. Because it is such a spontaneous film. It's a little bit rough around the edges. You don't necessarily know what's going to happen next. It's not necessarily even going to be a smooth ride getting there, but the trade-off for that is sheer excitement and audacity and having to contend with all of these themes, which I'm guessing is the point of this program to do. But there are a lot of little elements here that you can pick apart and examine and get a lot out of. I mean, you just mentioned the gig economy. I don't know if we've had a film. I can't think of a film that's really articulated that very specific thing as well as Sorry to Bother You, or even really bother to address it, and yet it's such a major part of the economy as it is right now and the way young people live right now and how the people overwork and they live sort of hand to mouth. I mean, it feels so real and so of the moment. And maybe that's, as a Putney Swope-esque excitement to it.
It's uncompromising. I mean, Boots Riley describes himself as communist. I mean, he's that, that far to the left and really feels like what will change things is a full-on work stoppage across the country. And that is in here. That's definitely at the heart of this movie. It's not even like sugar to make the medicine go down. It's just all folded into this really great freewheeling satire that does touch on, like you say, a lot of stuff. And it's like, if that is your position, you do not see developments like the gig economy and the sort of, the hero worship of your Elon Musk's of the world, which I think that's a lot of where the Armie Hammer character comes from. You do not see this as positive developments in your lifetime. I think you see these things as things taking a turn for the worse. And I think there's an urgency to this film as well because of that.
Yeah. In terms of it, like commenting on, the world today or whatever, like this film has been around in some variation. I think he finished his first draft in 2012, and then there was like a screenplay that ran in McSweeney's, I think, in 2014. Like, he's been working on this film for a long time, and that may account for its overstuffedness. But I think in terms of, things like the gig economy or commenting on Elon Musk, like, it may not have been initially formulated as comments on those specific things, but I think they may have grown out of the deeper issues that enable those specific things that Riley is interested in.
He saw it coming. Yeah, there's the Coos 2012 album is Sorry to Bother You. And it's got a track called "We've Got a Lot to Teach You, Cassius Green." So it's like,
yeah. It's going to be my Your Next Picture Show. It's still going to be my Your Next Picture Show. Oh, there you go. Well, that's fine.
Spoiler. Sorry about that. I've heard there might be an album. Old Jenny talking about that. But there's parts of it that felt like a little grounded in older trends. Like, I mean, telemarketing is obviously still with us, but maybe not in the form so much as it is here, like selling encyclopedias and such. Yeah. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. Don't call me. I don't know.
I would think not selling encyclopedias specifically. Like,
but I think it is sort of like the lowest possible level of capitalism you could cover. So it makes sense from that point of view.
I mean, it's very much built around the idea of, like, your inherent worth is based on how much you can bother and manipulate people. And it's very clear in everything that comes out of Armie Hammer's character that, like, workers at that level are seen as interchangeable and disposable and property. I mean, he's literally created a system under which people can sell themselves into new slavery in exchange for, like, horrible looking meals and uncomfortable looking working conditions.
The chandeliers, though. It's the classy chandeliers.
It is true. I think one of the hilariously subversive things about this film is just the fact that they have advertising that we see over and over for these work centers where you can sign yourself onto as a permanent worker. And even in the attempts to sell them, they look horrible. Like, there's no way to gloss over just how depressing they are, even with people grimacing through trying to sell the delicious food and comfortable living conditions. Like, they always look like somebody's prodding them with a taser from behind. Like, the message just comes across that you can't put a gloss on how horrible this stuff is.
Speaking of worry-free and what we were just talking about in terms of it being relevant to today, this is from the interview that Alyssa did with Boots Riley, where they were kind of talking about this. And apparently in the 2014 version of the screenplay that was published in McSweeney's, the line that is now "worry-free is resurrecting America" used to be "worry-free is making America great again." Mm-hmm. Actually, like, had to roll that back because it was like, as Riley says, the real world made my script too on the nose. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, I was thinking about worry-free. Is there a military metaphor here? It almost feels like the same kind of phenomenon of people who just can't make ends meet. They're young. What are they going to do? I mean, the lure of worry-free, of course, is the title is being able to sign up, give your body up to this organization and be assured 3 square a day and a place to sleep and be able to leave the worries of trying to make it in the economy behind.
Uncertainty. You're basically giving up uncertainty in exchange for horror. Which is, you know, kind of the thing we all have to contend with on a daily basis.
Yeah, I mean, and you go into it with a certain, there's enough salesmanship with both worry-free and with the military to make you think, like, well, maybe this could work. Maybe this could be a positive step in my life. Maybe it's not going to be so bad.
I mean, it reminds me more than anything of some of the things that Downsizing did. You know, Downsizing also is a film about kind of giving up your future in order to put yourself in an artificial environment where your future is theoretically entirely guaranteed for you because you've shrunk down to 3 inches tall and your money is more valuable. Like, it's the same sort of, you've been promised something that somebody else is profiting off of that supposedly benefits you, but ultimately you've become a product.
The military connection is interesting. I hadn't really thought of that because my mind just went immediately to the development over the last decade or so of the dissolving of the work-home divide. You know, when you think of these big corporations like Google or Amazon that, like, create these campuses that enable their employees to, they can be there all the time if they want to, you know, and like the evolution of your job becoming your whole life and becoming your identity and taking over every aspect of your life. And like, so that's what I was seeing as the thread that was being pulled on with Worry Free. But
Definitely. It was a freestyle kind of thought on my part.
No. And no, it totally makes sense. And I forget, I know, like, we definitely see Cash selling worry-free labor to a cell phone company. But, like, I feel like there was also maybe an implication with the Armie Hammer character of it being used for
arms dealing.
Yeah, for arms dealing. Yeah.
Yeah. So. I mean, it's left deliberately vague. Like, there's sort of a list of horrible things they supply, but I think it's kept as vague as it is because he wants you to use your imagination. The idea is simply the profit comes from doing all of the terrible things in the world. Like, what you need to succeed in a capitalist society is to completely sell out, sell your soul, and accept that there is nothing that is not basically valued by how much money you can make out of it. And I think that not pinning that down very specifically is part of like letting you engage with it however you want to, like politically or emotionally. What do you think is bad? They're doing it. Good.
Yeah.
I mean, Keith, and Genevieve, I guess, as well. I mean, you've been exposed to the albums by The Coup. Mm-hmm. What impressed me, I guess, about this film is that, unlike a lot of Marxist entertainment that I've seen, certainly on film, there's not a propagandizing element to it. It has a very nuanced understanding of the way the world actually works, mm-hmm. That it's not completely driven by this overarching ideology or this attempt to persuade people necessarily. Is that also true of the albums?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of humor on them, and there's a lot of storytelling, and there's a lot, you get a lot of different flavors from
I mean, it's
over the years.
Like, sonically, it sounds a lot like Boom Bap party music, you know, like it doesn't sound like it's, you know, quote unquote, serious music with serious ideas. Like the Coup definitely sort of Trojan horses these ideas into very, you know, consumer friendly sounding music, which I think is part of like the great irony that they're mm-hmm. that they're playing with, you know. I mean, obviously The Coup has never been a huge like mainstream success, but in terms of sort of the type of rap sounds and motifs that they trade in, it is definitely reflective of that sort of sound.
Yeah, I did a piece on The Coup's music videos for Vulture and kind of how the videos reflected the sensibility over the years. That's kind of evolved with them too. And there's a few little pieces here and there that kind of turn up in Sorry to Bother You. One of the best songs and one of the best videos is a total break, though, with that sort of the party music aspect, which is Being Jesus and the Pimp in a 79 Granada last night, which is like this very long story about a kid in an abusive relationship exacting revenge on a pimp. And it's total like Pulp Fiction material, but it's all very affecting and told from, you know, totally just deflating the idea, any sort of glorification of pimping and whatnot, and which is, and, you know, another extension of capitalism and it's in its most extreme. So, but yeah, no, The Coup's whole discography, it's all digging into. I'd start with the early stuff, but you can work backwards too.
Yeah,
we should talk about the performances. This is kind of, in some ways, the year of Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson. I guess Tessa Thompson bleeds over in the, they both bleed over in the last year as well. But they're both, you know, both great in this movie. Stanfield just has this quality that makes him perfect for this. He's like an everyman, but also kind of just a little off, just a little eccentric. This is the perfect person to have this adventure. And Thompson is, you know, really compelling.
She's a girl
with soul. Echo Putney Swope with a definitely a great sense of style. The kill, 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 murder, murder, yeah, murder, the earrings, and
which are for sale on the Annapurna store.
I mean, the movie itself sells those earrings.
Yeah,
but it also, I mean, it's seen through in its really interesting way too, where she has her own white voice to sell her art, and that it is a condition that extends beyond just sort of the telemarketing and the most obvious aspects of the market society.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she has made such a career out of characters who are very confident and very forthright mm-hmm. and very kind of set in themselves. And it feels like Lakeith is making a career out of people who are mostly just a bit baffled, just a bit thrown by the world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like his performance in Get Out, which is so chilling and memorable, is very different from his performance in Netflix Death Note, which is not a good film, mm-hmm. but he plays a very buttoned down, serious Sherlock type, who's also very like physically forward. But at the same time, he has a soulfulness. He's got soul. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a vulnerability that Tessa Thompson is in no way projecting. And that makes for just sort of an interesting dynamic between them, because he's so clearly doing so many of these things out of a desire to provide and to keep them safe and to keep her safe and, you know, to be a man, basically, in a world where his identity is based in his ability to provide. And her confidence and willingness to break down the system while he's getting his way deeper and deeper into it, I think is a really good dynamic that wouldn't work if they weren't both such sympathetic, like, player characters, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he has no set values in the way that she does, so that which makes him malleable enough to succeed in the way that he does, but also to be compromised in the way that he does.
And he's also, like, defined right from the beginning by worry. Like the first conversation between them is him worrying about death, you know, or like, dwelling on it. Like, in as far as, like, that character's arc, like, it makes sense for someone who is just so insecure about, like you said, their place in the world, or like what happens next, you know, like the bigger picture, so to speak.
While you're in there, you also kind of have to give a shout out to Danny Glover. It was a very small role, but it's so good. He's so perfect. It's just, you know, the voice of received wisdom who comes in to, you know, drop a little nugget of information and then kind of get out. There are a lot of fun, like, small performances.
Terry Crews, and not even a small part, but Steve Ewan is Squeeze. Like, I thought that character and that performance are great. I'm not really I never really watched The Walking Dead, so I didn't have a whole lot of context for him and his performance style, but I really liked him a lot here.
He was on The Walking
Dead. Oh, yes, I remember that.
I really like, speaking of that character, I like the predicament that Lakeith Stanfield's character is put in at that moment when he's getting promoted up to the power caller, mm-hmm. and he has these allegiances that he's made with other union workers who want to unionize and want to fight the system, and now he's part of it, and it's very hard to ask someone to sacrifice so much benefit that they would get from moving up the ladder to fight alongside you. And you can really feel that eating away at him, and it's part of that, again, that character of having no set values. It just sort of tears them apart, and you kind of live with that. I admire that a lot about the film.
They also, like, that insecurity just leads him into, like, I'm really not big on discomfort humor. I'm really not big on laughing at somebody who's squirming through an awful situation. But that party at Armie Hammer's place, where he's called upon first to reveal his big gangster backstory, which he points out he doesn't have one of, and then he's
while
called,
sitting, like, cross-legged on the floor.
In front of a fireplace, yeah. Basically, you know, being presented with this, like, satiricon level grouping of partiers lolling across each other, waiting to be entertained. There's so much symbolism in so many of the shots in this movie that's uncommented on. But then they ask him to rap, mm-hmm. and it's such a squirmy racial setup, because it's basically, we have preconceptions about you. We're a bunch of rich white people. You're black. This is the only way we know how to interact with you. And then they force him into it. And rather than walking away, he starts shouting, like, the N-word in a rhythmic fashion, which is so catchy. And they all pick it up and start chanting along. And it's like, you can understand why they would, because it's catchy and they feel that he's giving them permission. And that's just something we've seen so much dialogue about in society lately. The, you know, why can't I say that word? How can I get permission to say that word? That guy got fired for saying that word in what he thought in a private investor call. And he thought it was in quotes and it really wasn't.
It's so much better to engage with these situations in this film than in real life.
But that whole sequence, it's so funny, it's so uncomfortable, and then afterward, when he just kind of, like, goes off into a corner to lick his wounds, like, the film doesn't explain, like, what he's feeling in that moment. You can just see it on the Keith Stanfield's face.
Yeah, it's someone who decided to sell out, and then the whole selling out process has been a reckoning with how much that's going to take from him, and this seems like the lowest point he's reached that point.
And I don't think he sees any way back up out of it. You know, he knows he can give up everything that he has earned and attained and that he feels he's good at, and that doesn't seem possible. So how does he come back from heaping humiliation? It's a really uncomfortable film, and I think that's one of the reasons we all feel so refreshed by it, is just the fact that it contends with really uncomfortable things.
This is like a good place to wrap it up. Well, we're not done with Sorry to Bother You, but we're going to talk about it in relation to Putney Swope when we come back with Connections.
Hey, Youngblood, let me give you a tip. Use your white voice.
Man, I ain't got no white voice.
Oh, come on, you know what I mean. You have a white voice in there, you can use it. It's like when you're pulled over by the police.
Oh, no, I just use my regular voice when that happens. I just say, back the fuck up off the car, and don't nobody get hurt.
All right, man, I'm just trying to give you some game. You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
People say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Well, I mean, there's... You know, where do you start? I think, let me start with surrealism, because I think that's one element of Sorry to Bother You we didn't touch on that much above, how it'll just kind of break with reality. Like early on, the telemarketing scenes where they mm-hmm. literally drop his desk into the people he's calling. It's such a, so great. And like yeah. the way it's staged, the way it's played, where just Stanfield's character, it seems like it's really happening, but it also captures, like, you know, I hate it when people call me. I'm actually everyone, but especially telemarketers, you know, yeah. and that intrusiveness and the invasiveness. It's like, and right back to the title, like, Sorry to Bother You. It is, you know, this is me reaching into your space to try to get some money at the heart of it, no matter how we dress it up with the script.
And I feel like Putney Swope doesn't go nearly as far into surrealism. There are a bunch of things it does in terms of, like, repetition. And we've kind of joked on a couple of them, but just in terms of a character saying the same thing over and over and over until it leaves the arena of reality. And to me, that feels like poetic. It feels like we've sort of left cinema behind and we're moving into slam poetry. But it very rarely works for me in the way that, like, the Sorry to Bother You drop-ins do, because we all know what that's symbolizing. We all can relate to it. Like the insane repetition of certain phrases, like the girl's got to have soul. I'm not really sure what those things are meant to accomplish in Putney Swope.
Yeah, and speaking of, like, confusing surreality in Putney Swope, what's the...
Hing?
Yeah, the whole Hing monologue. I love that.
Explain it to me.
I felt like
when we were talking about moments that worked for us, I went through too many of them, so left that one out. But the whole Hing speech, where the guy just confronts Putney and a couple of other people in the street and starts into this, like, maybe Hingleberry or Hingsario. Hing spells nothing, begins nothing possible unto Webster. It is my very, very own Hing. Like, it is entirely possible that that is a reference to something that happened in Robert Downey Sr.'s life or something that was going on in art at the time, and I'm just missing the reference. But for me, it brought up so many sensations of the way people right now try to find anything that is theirs that they can hang on to, that can be their brand, that they can be the first person to present on social media, that they can kind of wrap their image around. This guy has one thing, and he's presenting it to, like, the most authoritative, powerful guy in this, like, creative industry. Like, it's a resume. Mm-hmm. I've created a thing. Like, it's possible that you could share in this thing. It may be a meaningless thing, but, like, it's my thing, and nobody else has it. And Putney just kind of looks at him and is like, okay, man, and just keeps going. And it's one of many ideas that's maybe not fully developed, but I find it really resonant.
I mean, I certainly remembered it. I just didn't understand it at all. But
I was baffled by that moment too, Genevieve.
So. Okay, good.
I really enjoyed it. Part of it is just the performance, though.
In terms of surrealism in Putney Swope, like, they're not technically surreal, but I feel like the way that the ads function in the movie is sort of a break with reality that you could call, like, borderline surreal, because so many of them are so clearly not any sort of advertising that you would ever see on television, you know? So they become these little pockets of, you know, I guess satire, but some of them are just so strange, like you can't eat an air conditioner, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's a thing where what's the difference between the surreal and absurd? Like, absurd describes it a lot better than
surreal. That exact line went through my mind yesterday when I was, like, preparing for this, like, what's the distinction between surreal and absurd in this context? Because I'm not really clear on it.
I think it might be Putney Swope speaking in Robert Downey Sr.'s voice, where it just kind of strange and off-putting versus Cassius Green sounding like David Cross, you know, which is a whole another level, and it has a deeper meaning. And Sorry to Bother You.
Yeah, because the Downey voiceover was kind of a matter of necessity. Like, the actor couldn't remember his lines.
That's the story.
Yeah,
anyway,
yes, that's what he says, and he says that he had to dub them because of that. Whether that's true or not, you know, who knows? But, like, in Sorry to Bother You, it is so clearly, like, part of the conception of the film, you know, with the idea of a white voice.
And it's also, I mean, in Sorry to Bother You, it's so important that what they're doing is putting on a pretense of being someone they're not in order to sell something that has no value to people mm-hmm. that don't want it. Whereas in Putney Swope, I feel like it takes you out of the narrative entirely, because here's a man that you're supposed to be respecting for his authenticity, and what you're hearing is so obviously artistically not him. If it was an aesthetic choice that wasn't based in that reason, if it was something that he found like satirical or surreal, I think it actually has the opposite effect of whatever was intended.
Yeah, I'm, I guess, willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, this Robert Downey Sr., about why the necessity of doing it. But I think there is a choice in the way that he projects this voice. I mean, it is a voice, and it's very consistent. I mean, it's like, it's, you know, to the point of being... I mean, it's not nuanced. It's he's just barking this.
It kind of sounds
voice.
Like he's like talking through a
vocoder.
No, like when you have a tracheotomy, the thing that you hold
those
to
just
your neck. Are they okay? I don't know.
I know what you're saying. Yeah,
it has like
a
voice box.
One of those words.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a choice there, right? I mean, to make the voice what it is, but it definitely doesn't. Whatever the point of it is, does not come through nearly as strongly as having David Cross do.
Or Patton. Oswalt.
And Patton Oswalt as well. Good choices for both of those voices.
So good.
Well, and that brings us to another issue, which is race, as it plays out in both these movies, the way that the white voice is sort of access to a different level of the world. And Sorry to Bother You, and very explicit racial theme of Putney Swope.
Yeah, with Sorry to Bother You in particular, like having seen it at Sundance and then not having seen it for months, I kind of came back to white voice as just, you know, a nasal friendly voice that doesn't sound threatening. I'm really afraid that what Robert Downey Sr. is trying to do in Putney Swope is project what he thinks of as blackness, which is like deep and threatening. If he had to record it over later, like he's clearly using ADR, why didn't he just get the actor to do the ADR after the fact? That's what bothers me.
It's interesting. I mean,
or another black actor. There were plenty of black actors on that set.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. I think he wanted something as off putting as that voice because it's so prominent in the film. I mean, it brings us into the whole set of issues here. It was like, you know, how radical can he be with these thoughts and how far can he take them as a white director? I'm not going to answer that question here. I don't think we're going to settle that. But, you know, he's definitely not shying away from racial issues either.
And there's a difference in terms of period, too. I mean, the notion of overdubbing someone's voice in a film in 1969 was not uncommon or something that people were not used
sure.
to.
Goldfinger, you know, he's talked about that.
Yeah, and now, but Sorry to Bother You is obviously a choice. I mean, right. and one that is very strong and resonant and a big part of the movie.
A part of what drives it in Sorry to Bother You is, like, as I say, having seen it at Sundance and then not for a while, I had these memories of what white voice meant, and it mostly was just sort of like the comedic element of these ridiculous voices coming out of these established actors. But Glover gives a detailed explanation of what it means, and it's, you know, it's political.
It's privilege.
Yeah.
You know, the belief that
you have nothing to worry about, that everything is fine. Everything is like your future is sorted, basically.
Yeah. There's the whole worry theme.
You don't need the sale. You know, you're relaxed and confident and not desperate at all to get the sale. So it's much more of like a conversation of like, hello, friend, I have something for you. You know, it's not like I need this commission to make rent.
I think it is interesting that the people that we see in the worry-free commercials who have sold themselves into worry-free are, if not exclusively white people, then certainly prominently white people. Like, I'm hard-pressed to point out another really positive portrayal of a white person in Sorry to Bother You. But we are being told that this isn't just a matter of like one white guy who's reintroduced slavery solely for people of color. Like everybody is under him. He has purchased everybody.
That said, I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, that all the Equisapiens are black men.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Forrest Whitaker is the voice of the one that we hear. And then the one that Cash speaks to in the paddy wagon, I'm pretty sure is a black character.
And I think that goes to what Tasha was saying too, that there's within the sort of the confinements of this very far advanced beyond humanity version of capitalism in the film, there's the virtual slavery of that white people get, and there's the sort of the subhuman enslavement that black people get, and that's
and the negation of your black identity as you move up in the world, as evidenced by the there's no white voice only on the power caller level. You know, and the as Cash becomes more successful and has more material success, his white voice, like he can't control his white voice, like it comes out when he's not trying to do it.
It's a really powerful metaphor that's played out in extremely effective ways.
Yeah, it's also clear that Worry Free is being sold to black and white communities differently. You know, yes. We see the advertisement, not just the TV advertisement, but like billboard advertisement for basically the white version of Worry Free, which is, you know, very family oriented. And then the black version, you know, in a black community is, you know, prove that you're a good baby daddy, sign on for this. And it's like a solo black man who is expected to sign himself away. Like there's a lot of class issues as well as race issues just endemic in how it's being presented. And then there's the fact that Armie Hammer himself is so enthused by what he thinks he's offering poor people. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's actually really important to the satire of the film that he definitely does not think that he's doing anything wrong. Right. He thinks that he has brought this great and fascinating thing to the world. And one of my favorite little details from the film is just as he's washing Cassius watch his commercial for people being turned into equisapiens, like he's watching him with the avidity of a first-time novelist giving their 8,000-page manuscript to their significant other for the first time, and just like, you're going to read this, and I'm going to sit here and watch you and watch every twitch on your face as you watch. Like, he's so into it.
Boy, he did hire Michelle Gondry. Or not Michelle Gondry, but
it's like Gondry something
there's
like that.
There's a story there.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
Oh, what's the story?
It's in Alyssa's interview.
Yeah. So basically, he did this stop motion animation thing like with Michelle Gondry in mind. And he basically, the way he put it is, I didn't have to ask permission, but I really respect Gondry. So I showed it to him and like, hey, I'm doing this. Like, is it okay that I put your name on it? And Gondry was like, well, that's not really my style of animation. Someone might think I did that. And then Gondry was kind of like, oh, well, you know, you could pay me and I can actually do it. And Boots and Riley is like, I don't have the money to pay you for this. And Gondry was like, oh.
And it was like shortly before the film needed to premiere too, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like basically it came down to Gondry saying like, yeah, it's fine. But then like immediately after leaving the meeting, Boots Riley got a call saying that Michelle says, no, you have to change it. And Riley's like, well, I don't have to, but I will, and now I'm mad at you forever, Michelle Gondry. in that interview with Alyssa, he says, and I'm going to continue to diss him in each film until he answers me back.
Oh my God. Well, that's promising if he wants to make more films. Yeah. I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I would definitely be up for more Boots Riley films to come.
And going back to the like Armie Hammer's whole pitch to Cash, like what he is offering Cash specifically, and this I guess kind of opens us up to one of our other connections, like he is offering Cash the opportunity to be like a planted revolutionary, like the Martin Luther King figure among Equisapiens. And that is sort of just a real mind bender in terms of like what this film is saying about revolution within a corporate structure. And I would say that is pretty directly connected to some of the themes in Putney Swope.
Yeah, just about how the system co-ops everything and tries to bring everything in within it. What it can't cast out, it co-ops. And that's a really insidious idea at play there.
And I think, and Sorry to Bother You, when combined with the whole union thing, I think it's commenting on the nature of like individual revolutionaries as opposed to a collective, or revolution as a collective concern, you know, like something that people do together versus someone who is held up as a symbol of revolution, you know, and what the relative value or worth of those two things are.
One of the other things I really wanted to hit on with both of these films is just sort of the question of art, who it's for and what it looks like. With Tessa Thompson's character, you know, we have her creating the giant earrings that are now for sale, but we also have that strange interlude with her performance art where people are throwing cell phones and sheep blood at her, where she's like painting these giant clunky assemblages of wood in the shape of Africa. And there's a sense that she's doing something insanely non-commercial, and that's what makes it art. That's what defines it as art, is the fact that it's completely unsellable. I feel like in Putney Swope, there's a pretty strong implication that the ads that they create are meant to be art. And then if they're successful art because they're sold, because mm-hmm. they're saleable, because people appreciate them and hone in on them and stay home to watch them, because they take such a radical approach to selling things. It's almost like, you know, by having a woman with soul dancing mm-hmm. around in smoke, saying something about how you can't eat a refrigerator. It's almost like saying, because you can't necessarily define what's being sold or how or why, that makes this ad art. Like, that's what it feels like the film is saying at some points to me. So, I mean, it kind of just becomes a question, I think, in both films of, like, what is art? Who is it for? Like, is it a meaningful distinction?
I think with Detroit, it's not so much that it's unsellable. It's just going to a very rarefied clientele. It's not like people aren't there and aren't supporting what she's doing. It's this very upper level art crowd. I think it's just a matter of you know, it's kind of like she's become the power seller of the art world.
So what does it say then? What are both of these films must naturally be talking about their own author's relationship to art and capitalism and how they put their own work out into the world, the image they're trying to project and what they consider success to be, working within or working outside of the system, right? I mean, they have to be by nature movies about themselves in that respect.
Yeah, I mean Downey was making sort of avant-garde advertisements when he got the idea for this film. I mean, not avant-garde isn't quite the right word, like, but he was, I guess, working in, like, it wasn't a agency, but it was like a film house, you know, and they this is in one of the interviews with him on the DVD, mm-hmm. but he talked about how they kind of did these strange little, you know, ad spots that, like, the advertisers didn't want, but then would, like, play film festival, you know, or play a film festival or something, yeah. You know? So, like, I think just based on his own personal experience and, like, where he was coming from when he made this film, like, Downey, I think, is definitely thinking of the possibilities of advertising as artistic expression.
Yeah, and what about Boots Riley? I mean, this is kind of an interesting success level that he seems to be able to maintain, and maybe it's going to continue with this film of being, you know, kind of the head of what you would say maybe a cultish, sure. appreciated, yeah, band, sure. mm-hmm. and he's made this movie that seems to be destined to be culturally appreciated without necessarily busting through the mainstream. I mean, it feels like he understands, like, where to level the film at, you know, or maybe, I mean, or sensibility.
He's market savvy.
He's a market savvy person who's very distrusting of markets, but, like, he's positioned himself so savvily with this film, and then I guess with The Coup as well, which you all can speak to better than I can.
Yeah, well, I mean, it helps they're both good. I mean, it helps that they're saying something and saying it well, and there's an audience for that. I mean, you know, but again, we're getting into capitalist explanations as to why Boots Riley's career has worked as well as it is, and
can't escape,
you know, can't escape the system. But but no, I mean, I think this film is destined to be talked about and have an audience, and what if it's people that don't discover it on this first theatrical run, we'll pick it up later. But of course, we would recommend that you do go out and see it in the theater when you get a chance. It certainly plays well with the crowd, too, which is our way of saying that Sorry to Bother You is in theaters now and will be by the time you hear this episode. As for Putney Swope, it's available to rent online from a couple of streaming services, a couple of the more mainstream ones. It's also been on DVD a couple of times, both as an individual disc and as part of Criterion's Up All Night with Robert Downey Sr. box set, which also contains a handful of other Downey films.
It's also the YouTube version of it, actually, is pretty good.
Mister,
that's right.
Scott, you gave me Bringing so much crap.
Yeah, well, you were watching some like some spectacularly beautiful art film, were you not?
I was watching Rebecca.
Are you
yeah, exactly. Rebecca's gorgeous.
Are you smashing the system by stealing it?
You might say so. Yeah, all right. I've been known.
How revolutionary
of
you.
Revolutionary is definitely something that people have referred to me as.
All right, we'll be right back with your next picture show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we haven't seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, we kind of spoiled this already, but why don't we have you, while we're still talking about, sorry to bother you a little bit, what's been good for you in the world of film or film-related items lately?
Yes, I'm going the film-related item route this week. So I was really taken with the music in Sorry to Bother You, which was a collaboration between The Coup and the unfailingly eclectic indie dance group Toon Yards, who made the film's really kind of gripping, erratic score. And coming out of the film, I was all pumped to pull up the accompanying soundtrack. But as of this recording, there isn't one yet. Riley has said on Twitter there's a forthcoming soundtrack featuring all new songs and appearances by Janelle Monáe, Killer Mike, E-40, and more. But as of yet, that hasn't materialized beyond a single with featuring Lakeith Stanfield, which is very good. There's a chance that by the time this episode comes out, that soundtrack will be out. But in the meantime, I wanted to share the sort of soundtrack replacement I cobbled together after seeing the film. The first, as kind of we've already mentioned, is The Coup's 2012 album, which is confusingly titled Sorry to Bother You. In an interview with Riley, he said that he'd actually finished the first draft of the film shortly before releasing this album and originally thought it might end up being the soundtrack, but discovered after shooting it didn't really fit the aesthetic of the movie. So there will eventually be a soundtrack called Sorry to Bother You by The Coup, but there's already an album by The Coup called Sorry to Bother You. And if you responded to this film, I say it's definitely worth your time. The Coup, as we discussed, have always been kind of adept at blending sort of party rap sounds and motifs with like clever, witty, socially aware lyrics and ideas. And this album definitely extends that trend, but with a stronger funk element coming through than in older albums. This one is all live instrumentation with no samples, which gives it sort of a live party atmosphere, except it's a party where Boots Riley is lecturing you about education reform and Marxist principles. Mm-hmm. So hopefully you can see how that kind of aligns with this film, and we'll check it out. The second related recommendation is for Toon Yards' latest album, which came out at the beginning of this year and is called I Can Feel You Creep Into My Private Life. Toon Yards has a very distinctive sort of atonal skittering sound that brings in a lot of world music influences. But this album takes them in a much more dance music oriented direction that I think makes for a very complimentary listen with that Coup album, Sorry to Bother You. It's also an album that has sort of a thin veneer of party music that overlays more urgent and sober lyrical concerns. And with this album in particular, frontwoman Meryl Garbus is engaging lyrically with some weighty ideas regarding appropriation and privilege in her quote-unquote white woman's voice, as she puts it in a song titled Colonizer. So that kind of gives you an idea of what this album is wrestling with. It's a really arresting sort of immediately catchy album that reveals some deeper and more difficult conversations at its core, and listening to it, you can totally understand why Riley would want Toon Yards to score his film. So I've been kind of cycling between these two albums for the past few days in lieu of an actual Sorry to Bother You soundtrack. So if that hasn't materialized by the time this episode drops, I would suggest The Coup's 2012 album Sorry to Bother You and Toon Yards' new album I Can Feel You Creep Into My Private Life. Scott, what about you?
I posted, I think, with everybody else, sort of a halftime top 10 list. And my top five were like things that we had already talked about on the show. Annihilation, First Reformed. I mentioned as a next picture show, Did You Wonder Who Fired the Gun? And The Rider. But we never really got a chance to talk about the Lynn Ramsey movie, You Were Never Really Here, which I really love and which just became available recently to stream. Lynn Ramsey did Morvern Collar and Ratcatcher. Morvern Collar was the inspiration, incidentally, for my old film column, New Cult Canon. That was kind of the movie that I really wanted to write about, and then that kind of sparked this thought about doing a bunch of other sort of recent cult films. But in any case, You Were Never Really Here is an existential thriller that's sort of a riff on Taxi Driver. There's a lot of shared elements. There's a loner anti-hero with a military background. There's a political campaign. There's an effort to save, quote-unquote, an underage girl from a prostitution ring. So they have those connections, but in true Lynn Ramsey style, it is a much more elliptical and internalized piece in which you kind of discover through this character played by Joaquin Phoenix just how much damage has been done to him over time and how soul hurt he is. You know, Stripped to the Bone, it's really a pretty brutal version of like a Taken or a John Wick or the Equalizer, you know, just one man just kind of blasting his way through, or in this case, hammering his way through a lot of bad guys in the criminal underworld. But the difference is that Ramsey sort of turns it inward and reveals more about this man who's only known violence since childhood and who cannot keep himself from perpetuating it. So I really recommend it. I mean, it is a tough watch. You have to be nice and strong stomached, but it's very bold. It's got an amazing Johnny Greenwood score that she uses quite sparingly, I thought, for a score that's that awesome. But she also likes to use a lot of songs, as fans of Mormon Collar know. So she's got a little bit of both in there. And I think it's one of those movies that's just going to get better every time you watch it, because these films are really dense with a lot of visual and aural information. And yeah, Alex, you all saw it, right? Did anyone else see it?
Not yet.
I saw it with you.
No, it's great. Yeah. And just, you know, you say it's a tough set, and it is, but she does something really interesting with violence that I won't spoil here. But
that's true.
About what gets shown and what doesn't.
Yeah, definitely. Mm.
Yeah, we talked about doing it on the show and pairing it with Taxi Driver, and we're stymied by Chicago screening schedule and recording times. Yeah. So it unfortunately never came together, but we found another reason to talk about. We were going to pair it with Taxi Driver, and we found another reason to talk about Taxi Driver.
Turns out Taxi Driver is a film that people reflect on quite often.
It's a year of Taxi Driver.
Keith?
Oh boy! Well, I've been watching a lot of Stephen King films lately. Everyone for a couple pieces I'm writing, and some of them weren't so great. Some of them were pretty good though. And you know, after you get past, I think the early King adaptations, like say 1985 and before, you get three great ones.
Yeah.
You get Carrie, you get Shining, you get The Dead Zone, which I think is probably not acknowledged enough how good that movie is.
The Dead Zone?
Yeah. It's really great. It's Cronenberg and King kind of...
Christine's not far from there either.
Yeah, I need to watch that again. Yeah. That one again. But I was confirmed how good Cujo is. Cujo is just a really solid, tight, technically accomplished genre film. It's from Louis Teague, who previously dealt with Dangerous Beasts on the film Alligator, which is a very good kind of Jaws inspired film set in New York. Cujo is I don't probably have to tell you. It basically boils down to mother and son fending for themselves against a rabbit Saint Bernard while trapped in a Pinto. It is whatever the opposite of product placement is that the Ford Pinto is in this, because everything goes wrong and it's very vulnerable to a dog attack. But I mean, it's a pretty faithful adaptation of the novel. It brings in a lot of what makes the book work, which isn't just big dogs are scary, but it's all like sort of the disintegrating family and domestic abuse and all the things that make Stephen King an interesting writer beyond his ability to summon up scares. It's all kind of there in a tight little 90-minute package. It does not keep the ending of the book. I think audiences would have torn the seats out of theaters if they had. But if you're looking for a good little thriller, Cujo, it'll do.
That dog is surprisingly frightening. If you read anything about the making of that movie, you know, it's one of those stories of like how we took a big friendly dog and tried to use camera trickery and bacon in order to make it terrifying. But it's so much more convincing than most dog work. Like, very often with films, you can kind of sense that the dog is like literally two frames away from like wagging its tail and licking the person it's snarling at. But Cujo is scary.
Yeah, it's very. And I'm a dog person.
Those are big, cuddly, lovable dogs.
The end of it, he's a hideous mess. Yeah, it's really disturbing.
Rabies, man. Don't try it. How about?
Recommended Cujo, not recommended.
Can't
rabies.
Eat a refrigerator. Yeah. Don't recommend rabies.
Even watching that film, it's like, oh, so cute, just chasing that rabbit. Don't chase that rabbit. There's bats in that hole. All right, Tasha, how about you? What have you seen lately?
Not a whole lot, but the other day I was on Netflix and a new film popped up that I hadn't heard of, because Netflix did, as far as I can tell, no advertising for this whatsoever. They are so erratic about what they tell us about in advance. And this was just one of those, it's Friday, let's drop a film. It's called Tau, T-A-U. It is the first film of Federico D'Alessandro, who is mostly known for doing a lot of special effects work and behind-the-scenes animatic work and various functions on like some of the big Marvel movies. a lot of the big Marvel movies. He was the animatics supervisor or storyboard artist for a bunch of the Thor films, Captain America, First Avenger, and Winter Soldier, Ant-Man, Doctor Strange, and also just films like Terminator Genesis, Where the Wild Things Are. So he's been in the industry for a while in a very non-visible role, and he made this little film. This is one of those films of discovery that, like, the less you know about it going in, the better. But the setup is sort of woman is trapped in a smart home. And before that, it's woman is abducted by scary man with strange technological plans. It goes into a place that reminds me a lot of the women in basement thrillers from a couple years ago, Ex Machina and 10 Cloverfield Lane, that particular sort of vein of clever, dynamic woman trying to fight insurmountable odds in an environment that's against her. In this case, the environment that's against her is a smart home run by a computer voiced by Gary Oldman and owned by another very hostile Elon Musk, like techno producer character played by Ed Skrein, who you might remember as the villain from Deadpool. And it's not anywhere near as good as Silence of the Lambs, but it goes in a very Silence of the Lambs direction in terms of his relationship to her and how they interact in this house and with the project that emerges from it, which is very much about emergent technology. I'm not going to get into plot details past that because it's a film of discovery, but it is certainly a small film and a flawed film. It's the kind of film that Netflix likes to pick up for cheap and just kind of toss on the site and see how it performs. But it surprised me in a number of ways. One of the big ones being the star is Micah Monroe, who you will remember as the female lead in It Follows and The Guest. Mm-hmm. She's really, really good. She's got the horror movie necessity of like coming across as tough and vulnerable at the same time, of being able to evoke both fear and determination. And this role demands a lot of her. She's very often the only person on screen in the movie. So you get to see her kind of work her way through her paces. Ed Skrein's pretty terrifying, and Gary Oldman is really interesting in a way that kind of reminded me of Kevin Spacey's robo character in Moon. So this is definitely not something that you should drop everything and run to see. But if you like little personal creepy techno thrillers, and particularly if you like films like 10 Cloverfield Lane, and if you're already a subscriber to Netflix and you're just looking for the next thing to watch over there, I would recommend it. Tau, T-A-U.
Tau. sounds a lot like Demon Seed. Have you seen that?
I have not. Okay, right. Wait, is that? Oh no, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Electric Dreams.
Yeah, no. Different.
Well, different, but similar.
Are they different though?
Ooh.
And that's it for this edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing comes out August 7th and 14th. Tasha, what are we discussing?
Okay, my mission, which I choose to accept, is to describe this pairing to you in 1 minute or less. Back in 1996, Brian De Palma directed the original Mission Impossible, an action film starring Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt, a government agent with a group called the Impossible Mission Force. When the group is compromised, he goes on the run with disavowed IMF agents played by Ving Rhames and John Reno. At the time, the movie was hailed for its cutting-edge special effects and for Cruise's strong physical performance as Hunt. But the series, inspired by a 1960 TV series about a similar group of daring agents using high-tech to perform missions with a high degree of difficulty, has had to constantly up its game to keep up with the times. The sixth film in the Mission Impossible series, written and directed by returning director Christopher McQuarrie, is Mission Impossible Fallout. It brings Cruise back yet again, and given the title, it's appropriate that it deals with the fallout of McQuarrie's 2015 film, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. We're going to look back on the run of Mission Impossible films, consider what makes Ethan Hunt such an enduring hero, and discuss how the franchise has evolved to keep pace with our conception of government agents fighting problems behind the scene. Oof. Mission accomplished. Your podcast player will self-destruct in 3 minutes.
Wow, we better get this outro done quickly then. We'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Putney Swope, Sorry to Bother You, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve?
You can find my work at the culture section at Vox.com, and you can find me occasionally tweeting on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha?
You can find me at Tasha Robinson on Twitter, where I tweet somewhat more frequently. And I am the film and TV editor at TheVerge.com, where you can find my writing. Scott?
You can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. I tweet about film sometimes, but mostly these days I get really mad about politics. You can also find my work at New York Times, Washington Post, Vulture, Variety, NPR, and other outlets. Keith?
You can find me on Twitter at KFIPS3000, where I mostly just tweet sad things. not really. But you can find my work at The Verge. You can find it at Vulture. You can find it at Rolling Stone. I've got a recent piece in Polygon. I'll be in the Chicago Reader at some point. I'm all over the place these days, and I collect my clips at KeithFIPS.com. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net. Via Twitter at NextPicturePod, and via Facebook at Facebook.com/NextPictureShow. If you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance producing the podcast, and thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space at her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be a part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. Oh, yeah.